Today we have Bridget Fetisee on the podcast. Bridget is a writer and stand-up comedian who has contributed to a wide variety of publications such as Spectator USA, Huffington Post, Playboy, Tablet Magazine, The Washington Examiner, and more. As the owner and operator of Fetisee Inc., she has built a digital media empire, leveraging existing platforms such as Twitter, YouTube, and Locals to deliver insightful and compelling commentary and observations on current events. Her YouTube show, Dumpster Fire, is a satirical commentary on the ridiculousness of the 24-hour news cycle, and her weekly podcast, Walk-In's Welcome, has become staple listening for many influencers in the social media space. Bridget, what's up?
Hi. We consider it a media cul-de-sac. It's not really an empire yet.
You wrote cul-de-sac. I should say, for the record, I take responsibility for calling it an empire.
I appreciate your optimism and your belief in me.
I wanted to signal belief.
We're going with that cul-de-sac. Hi. Cool. Thanks for having me. We need to get you on the podcast.
Oh, that'd be a lot of fun. Yeah, let's do that.
Have a crossover event.
Cool. Well, let's get through this one first. You know, we're not done with this shit yet.
I'm already like, welcome to my podcast.
I know. That's so funny. Well, look, okay. Let me just take a step back and just make a meta comment. I really do. I feel like, I like your energy. Let me start off saying I like your energy. I feel like we have a similar sort of absurdity philosophy. So I want to start there because I really am an absurdist at heart. And I feel like I certainly can't take myself too seriously. Like if I start to take myself too seriously, I get depressed, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like you're similar.
Yeah. I always say I kind of have a mantra, take the work seriously, don't take yourself seriously. Yeah. Yeah. And I was thinking about the whole idea of absurdity yesterday when I had people taking me totally seriously. And you make a joke on Twitter and it just is an endless barrage of people taking it seriously and taking themselves seriously. And I was like, I could handle losing almost anything except my sense of humor. Because I've used my sense of humor, even I was thinking, you know, extremely, like, what are the extreme things? Even my legs. Would I rather lose my legs or my sense of humor? You know, like I was asking myself this question. And losing your legs would suck completely, obviously. Yeah. But it would suck way more if you had no sense of humor.
I think about this all the time, believe it or not. I think about this all the time as like, please don't take away, you know, you could take away all my other dignities, but not my sense of humor.
I'm Irish Catholic and I don't, you know, we laughed at wakes. It's really how I've seen myself through some very dark times in my life. I was kind of the jester in my rehab. I always just wanted to make people laugh there. Mm. I have been in situations that are dark and I've really wanted to lighten them up because I find that it is the best way to get through any kind of hell. I mean, I have to be able to laugh at it. At a certain point, even when it's really gnarly.
I agree. I mean, are you ever in like a dark situation and you make a joke and people are like, that's inappropriate, you know, and you almost want to be like, but if I didn't joke, I would go insane, you know? So yeah. Like, what's my alternative, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I also don't think that it's right for people to take away your agency about joking about dark things. People will often go after people for rape jokes, for example. And yeah. I feel like they've helped me. I was drugged and raped. Joking about it has helped me heal that part of it. And it also, hearing people make funny jokes about it and being able to laugh at it has taken me from being a victim and out of that victimhood mentality that would be so easy to identify with. So I feel like it's really helped me process that horrible thing and move through it in a way that I can, you know, it's still a very serious thing, obviously, but it's not something that's going to define me for the rest of my life.
That's really, really interesting. Do you ever get like non-victim shaming by victims of sexual assault who say, who don't want you to, like they want you to kind of stay in the victimhood mode? Because it, I mean, this is actually a very sensitive topic, obviously. But, yeah. But does that ever happen? Because I see this happen sometimes with some people who go through such a terrible thing. And then, you know, they say, well, I'm no longer a victim. But those who are not there yet, you know, it's kind of like you can't pull off someone's defenses. That's one of the biggest thing we learn in psychology. You know, if I have a client who's not there yet, you know, you can't just say, oh, just stop being a victim. You know what I mean? I know you're not saying that, but you see what I'm saying.
No, I think that there's an overall tendency in the culture to want to be sensitive. And I don't think that's a horrible thing. I appreciate that everybody is so much of it feels like, I mean, I say that, but I think a lot of it just feels like lip service. So there seems to be people who will come after me and say, oh, you know, that might be funny for you, but it wasn't funny for me. And there are a lot of other people who are seeing this and they've been through something and, you know, it should have a trigger warning or it should be something that you take more seriously because other people take it seriously. And I just can't, I am not responsible for every single, the way every single person in the world interprets something that I say or a tweet that they might see of mine or joke, or I'm not responsible. It's like the first thing you learn in recovery. It's like none of my business how people feel. And
interestingly enough, another way of framing that is that people need to take some sort of responsibility for themselves in how they are affected by words or a joke. That's another way of framing it, you know, as opposed to kind of getting the pressure off you, you know, to some degree, I think, you know, responsibility needs to happen in every kind of direction.
I feel like that's a healthy thing. I mean, that was the first thing I learned in rehab when I was 19. I remember I was whining about how some of the girls were pushing my buttons, and the women who saved my life at that rehab, they were like, yeah, and they're your buttons. So why don't you start looking at why these things are upsetting you? And obviously, some things are upsetting in the world, and you have a right to react to them and to push back or to feel like there's an injustice or to feel upset. But there is a certain, I know that, I love that. There's so many platitudes that I love. The one being put down the microscope and pick up the mirror. You know, you'll be like hyper focusing on something that someone either said to you or some perceived slight or a perceived grievance or something someone else is doing, or for every finger that you're pointing, there are three pointing back at you. Yeah. This is really why I love Jonathan Haidt and so much of his work. And I do want to have that quote of his that's, we're all self-righteous hypocrites who are so good at putting on a show of virtue that we forget we're even putting on a show. And I have to, that's where the sense of humor comes in, because I have to remember that. We on Dumpster Fire will be making jokes and we'll contradict ourselves 2 seconds later. And
I love that.
I have to be able to laugh at that.
There's a certain kind of personality that like they can kind of come at you with a certain sanctimonious tone, and you know it just by the tone, even though you don't even hear the words, you know, like even if you couldn't, like if it was a different language, let's say it was like Klingon, like it would still be the same, like you'd be like, you like, I know that you're being sanctimonious, right? But usually when that is coming at me, it usually lacks all humor. Like, not, I'm not saying there needs to be humor in every situation, like obviously, but that person, I feel like I can't engage with them in any kind of relational, like I find humor is really good as a relational way, is dissolving tensions. I think it's an underestimated, you know, like tool for that people can use, who even hate each other, you know, like it can even be funny, even just saying like, oh, look, it's my arch nemesis, Bob, again, you know, like, and both of them laughing, like there's something about that steps you both above yourselves. Do you know what I mean? But do you know what I'm saying? There's a certain kind of person that can kind of come at you with a certain sanctimonious tone that you feel like you can't even, like, we're not allowed to play at all. No, we can't, like, really? Like, zero?
Yeah, it's people who take themselves too seriously. Well, and it's people looking for offense everywhere they go, which is really just self-importance. You know, just finding ways to be offended everywhere in the world is really just thinking that you are so important that I don't know. I feel like an old lady most of the time when I'm dealing with younger people, because I come from just like a who gives a shit. I don't know if you can swear on here, but my family was very just like, you're nothing. Not, you know, they're East Coast. They're kind of just like, the world doesn't owe you anything. What can you bring to the world? You didn't get up and try and make the best of things. I found that my life really changed a lot when I started waking up and I started saying, and if, when I don't do this, I notice a huge difference in my day. What can I bring to the world instead of what can I get? Because I will easily fall into, I'm not getting enough. I don't have enough. Why does X have more than me? Where are my accolades? How come no one's giving me credit? You know, all the like stupid trivialities of the ego that you get trapped in, and mostly just results oriented feelings that are outside of me being in the process or me being in the work or me being in the moment.
I love that. Do you ever feel though you may go too far and you could use a little more self-respect? Like, do you ever find that you can go so opposite in that direction that like you don't stand up for yourself sometimes? Just curious.
Probably. I don't stand up for myself, but I probably could use some positive affirmations or something in the morning.
I feel like I want to give you some positive affirmations.
No, I mean, my self-talk is not great. You know, I definitely have that East Coast kind of like, oh, what, you think you're better than us, Brit? That voice is the voice in my head. And it's not, and self, I've used self-deprecation as a tool to survive when I was moving a lot, and also just, it's part of, we were kind of raised and just not take ourselves seriously. My cousin Maggie and I talk about this all the time. It's like, you have to learn how to laugh at yourself or everyone else will be laughing at you. It's just it was a functional tool in a ginormous Irish Catholic family. I always joke that my upbringing was a roast battle. You know, you just had to, it was sink or swim. And self-deprecation is a way to make people comfortable is very useful, particularly when you're a woman trying to, or a young teenage girl trying to navigate multiple junior highs and high schools. So some of that is just, I think, habit, you know, but I also think self-deprecation is hilarious. It's good to be able to poke fun at yourself, but yeah, I mean, probably I could use a little bit more self-esteem, but I don't know. I'm not, I feel fine. I probably have, you know, body dysmorphia and, I don't know. It's so, you know, we have such a hard time seeing ourselves.
Yeah, it's true.
I don't think it's so hard to see, and so much of social media and everything that we're projecting, it is just that. It's a projection. So many tweets and I'm like, wow, this is a whole lot of projection wrapped so in one little tweet.
But it must feel good self-esteem wise to know you've so many people who love you. I mean, they adore you. I mean, I'm not talking about a little, I'm talking about a lot of people. Like, what does that do to your self-esteem?
I don't know. I can't really make it based on, there's a lot of people who hate me and I don't look at my analytics people. I don't look at analytics for my podcast. I have to stay out of that because being that it's a weird thing when you are the brand, this new, you know, which I knew was coming even in 2005 when I started Fetacy, and it's, I'm not as great as taking it not so personally. You know, every subscriber, every person who unsubscribes, that it could be financial. It could have 90% of it could have nothing to do with me, but some of it could be actually because of something I said or did. And so trying to detach a little bit from that and taking it personally can be challenging. And again, it's like doing the spiritual work, as much as I think that word's been destroyed. When I'm not in that place is generally when I'm more suspect to letting how many people like or hate me. I mean, it really is like the If poem, Rudyard Kipling.
I love that poem. Yeah.
We had that growing up. And I really think it's like not letting praise or blame or how many people love you or hate you really get, kind of finding that nice space where you can appreciate those things and taking criticism that is meaningful and also just be a self-contained human.
Bridget Phetasy, I tested you with my question and you passed with flying colors. That was exactly that was the right answer. Everything you
I
just
didn't
said.
I know that was the right answer.
You know, because like if you responded like, yes, my followers, you know, like my entire self-esteem is based on whether or not they like me or not, I'd be like, we need to talk. But I loved your answer. I loved that so much.
Thank you.
You know,
it can't be based on that.
It can't be. Yeah.
See what that does to young women, even like YouTube Instagram influencers, and they have public breakdowns because it's too much on the external.
Again, you mentioned Jonathan Haidt earlier. He's definitely pinpointed that, you know, the depression and a lot of these anxiety issues are teenage girls. They get a big brunt of a lot of the mental health issues because of the online presence and bullying and stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't imagine what it's like to be a young person online right now and in the world, just as unsettled as it is, and growing up and feeling like the adults are just as afraid and histrionic and confused as the average teenager is, and looking around and not really feeling like there's any real sense of truth or any real direction that makes sense. And I definitely understand, you know, when you do start, I have this ongoing joke of like, we must feed the algorithm. We must feed the algorithm. And it's like this little, I imagine the algorithm is this little troll under a bridge that you need to kind of pay tribute to in order to get. And once you're in that, even YouTube is a great example, because I wasn't willing to go on YouTube until I could be consistent, which I know is part of what makes something like YouTube successful if you're going to go on there. And you see analytically, you know, people who will look at the analytics I get secondhand reports about analytics, like, how's it doing? But you can absolutely see, I can see it just in subscribers or t-shirt sales. There's a big jump when you feed the algorithm. So I can understand that pressure to keep giving the content and keep feeding it with more. And I think it contributes to a lot of the breakdowns you see with some of these influencers.
You're right. I mean, like a drug, you're right. Like a drug pusher will give you more drugs. Like if you have the money, the drug pusher will give you more drugs. The drug pusher is not saying, you know what, I'm cutting you off. You know, like I really care about you and your well-being, and I don't want you to get addicted. You know, like, you know, how many drug dealers say that, you know?
I mean, you hear about this in the rooms of recovery, because usually you're driving your drug dealer insane and they're like, leave me alone, you have a problem.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah.
So it does occur, but yeah, there's not in the digital realm, there's not much of it. As somebody who does wrestle with addiction, it is something I absolutely have to watch out for. And that dopamine hit that you're getting and the refreshing and all the rewards you get, and the way that it's made so that it's, you just never know. You know, it's not, I forget what the exact term is, when it's like it comes in at different times. It's not like you get, you know, 100 likes every hour. You get, sometimes it's like 1,000, and sometimes there's a term for this. It's it's
intermittent, it's reinforcement.
Intermittent, yeah.
Reinforcement, yeah.
It's all designed to get us hooked, and And even just from the perspective of like let's say take a very simple metric like followers, there's, I know it will never be enough. It doesn't matter. I can have Rihanna level followings and it will not satisfy the desire for more. And so that piece is something I really have to do a shitload of work around on a daily basis.
You know, I'm looking at you, I'm listening to you, and I'm like, you sound like you have your head on your shoulders here, you know? But I have some quotes from you from some of your other interviews that I just want to read some things you've said. You said, quote, "I'm an after school special in real life."
Yeah, that's true.
You said, "I feel like I'm in a giant game of improv."
That's also true.
That's another one. Another one thing you said is, growing up, I didn't know what my values were. And I guess that was growing up with a religious family. You know, you didn't know what your own personal values were, right?
Yeah. I think I had good values instilled in the sense that I had really great manners. I knew not to hurt people. I just those kind of basic ones. I think when I say that, I mean more in the perspective now, being in the weird kind of space that I'm in, what are the values that I would kind of die for? You know, what are the hills I will die on? And I don't think that I thought through in terms of just the culture wars or in terms of the culture or how I was in my 20s. I really am a bleeding heart liberal still. My default reaction to every single news story is libtard. You know, like it really is just like that is my factory settings. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised a blue blood liberal. I know my bias. You know, I know that I'm coming from and always the place that, although I've lost a lot of trust in anything that's being presented, but I think that I come from a place of feeling like only the left wing cares about people and the right wing doesn't, you know? So that's just where I grew up and came from. And that is a weird cultural value to hold because it otherizes otherizes so many of my countrymen. And what I've realized is I do think most people care, you know, about other people. And it's just going about helping those people in different ways. And what's the best way to actually help people? And most of it in the media just and politics seems like lip service where people are just being used as populations to kind of manipulate and fight with each other. So I don't even believe that anyone's trying to help anyone on that kind of bigger, the parade or the show that we get from the media and our politicians. But on the individual level, I don't think that I really ever considered what free speech was. You know, when I didn't go to college, I was drunk for like most of my 20s. And I do feel like I came out of a blackout and then got thrown into a giant game of improv, which there have been moments where I'm like, what? Like going on Glenn Beck's show was a perfect example. I remember sitting across from him and having a moment being like, wow, this improv game has taken on a life of its own. You know, you're like, yes. And now I'll go. And it's all been, I don't know. It's been super wild and interesting because I've really had to kind of grow up publicly and I'm going to get a lot wrong a lot.
I love that humility. Just to circle back on the political things you were saying, do you still describe yourself as politically homeless?
Yeah, I don't feel like anyone represents really maybe there's some, I feel more libertarian, I guess, than anything else. Interesting. But I don't really know what that means. I mean, I guess what I mean. Like,
because you have like right libertarians, you have left libertarians. It's like you have different, a lot of varieties. Yeah.
I'm not really sure. I know that I want less government, and I know that I'm with Nick Gillespie saying, you know, I want less government doing the things that they do better than they're doing them, like doing a few things well. I live in California, as you know, and it seems like we have the biggest government of any of the states. And I drive around and I feel like Cardi B, you know, I'm like, where's my money? Where's my money going?
Now that's a conversation I'd like to see on your podcast, you and Cardi B.
She's fascinating to me, but I don't know. It's weird to be in the position of, I understand, like, for example, there's so much anger in the streets right now, you know, there, and much of it I think is justifiable. Some of it, and I think conservatives have this desire to be like, well, look at the facts. And it's like, okay, that is good. But we still have to address, there's some like big fundamental problems that we can't just ignore either. Yeah. And as somebody who's a bleeding heart liberal at heart, I'll see, you know, videos of a mother crying and a community in pain. And I'm like, that's real pain that they're in. This isn't like manufactured, you know, there are communities that have been disadvantaged and looked over and have been treated differently. And to ignore that is just ridiculous to me. And it's why I sometimes feel like on the right, there's this tendency to want to kind of factualize everything away, which I also understand, because being the person of like coming from a liberal background and being thrown into this crazy culture war and now having to evaluate every story, like, okay, we're going to pause. Even if my automatic reaction to this is like, are you fucking kidding me again? You know, like, again with this. Even if that's my just default reaction, I have to take a step and pause and breathe and wait for more information and try and reasonably evaluate things. But I mean, I think everyone's just reacting right now, all across the board.
Yeah, called it,
our culture is so reactive.
Yeah. I have a whole list of quotes here from you. So you've called that commodified outrage. That's what you've referred to it. But also, even just in our Twitter DMs, I have a quote here from you. Histrionic disorders are running rampant. Do you, how are these linked?
You know, some of that it's so hard because some of the outrage is real and justified. And I don't want to minimize that. Yeah, some of it is being absolutely amplified. It doesn't seem like there's any incentive for anyone to dial it down. Not politicians, not the media, not the individual, because we live in a society where victimhood is now something that you can make money off of. You obviously get more control over your population if they're divided and fighting with each other. You obviously have to have two sides fighting one another if you're in the kind of talking head pundit media space where you need that back and forth to keep your little grievance making machines going. And I mean, everybody's being sold grievances. It's just everyone. There's no one is immune to that, really. And myself included, I have to watch it too. But, and then you have the social media thrown on top of all of this, and people just It's like bad overacting. You know, I feel like everyone's become a method actor where they're like, and now I've got my shot. And I cried tears of joy and relief. Tears of sadness, tears of rage. It's like, just get your fucking, sorry, just get your shot and like go home, you know? Like, I don't know. It just seems so melodramatic to me. It's history. It is histrionics. One of my favorite things on Dumpster Fire is faux histrionics. I love like faux that's my favorite thing to do on that show. It's this way where I can express this kind of fake outrage because it seems it's so funny. It comes from everywhere. You just see all of these insanely ridiculous foes.
I asked you if you were on Clubhouse and you said no, it's Trap House, and by the way, that made me laugh.
That's my friend's quote, by the way. I can't like,
I didn't know that.
I
thought it was yours. I thought it was yours.
No, that's my friend. I can't take credit for that, but I also can't out who said that. But yeah, that's not mine, but I feel the same way.
but you know, I feel like there's a lot of material here if you were on Clubhouse, because there's a phrase that I heard someone use the other day. There's a lot of trauma dumping is what it's called. Trauma dumping on Clubhouse. But the thing is, if you're a moderator, and I like to moderate welcoming rooms, et cetera, you'll get in a lot of trouble if someone's trauma dumping and you dismiss it, or you don't give them the full hearing, or you don't show, you know, a lot of concern, you know, and say thanks so much for your vulnerability. But what's difficult sometimes from a moderator perspective is you want to keep things moving. You like, let's say you're having just a discussion, like a great discussion, intellectual, or a great discussion that's advancing things, and someone just like comes in and trauma dumps for like 20 minutes. It's actually quite disruptive to the, you know, to the conversation. Now I feel that's even insensitive saying that. You know what I mean? It's like like I just heard myself saying that, and I'm like, that sounded insensitive. But there's a time and place for trauma dumping, I guess, is what I'm saying. Does context matter anymore?
Yeah, it should matter. I don't know that it does, because again, we take everything out of context. So my experience with Clubhouse, I got in early-ish, probably even earlier than I could have probably gotten in earlier if I'd responded to any of the emails, but. I got in and I was listening, and my husband, who's also a therapist, was listening with me. I was like, you got to check this out. This is wild. And he's like, this is group therapy. Like one of the rooms we're in. And so I started to joke, and then it turned into a struggle session. So I was like, Clubhouse, come for the group therapy, stay for the struggle session. It was so bizarre. It was bizarre to me. It felt so, you know, I started feeling guilty because I felt like a voyeur in this very, like my husband was saying, there's so much therapy language being used, holding space, you know, like the trauma. And I mean, the one that I never, ever forgot was this woman who dared to utter that speech might not be violence in a room, and then she got booted, and then I stayed and I was listening to everybody, and they were holding space and they had to process their trauma from her even suggesting that speech might not be violence. I know a lot of people might have been traumatized by those words, blah blah blah. I was like, wow, this is like being in a zoo or an asylum. I didn't even know. You feel like, if I started feeling guilty because I'm like, oh, this is taking a tour through these rooms of the mentally ill. I don't know what's really happening here. Or rehab. It felt a lot like rehab when you're in group therapy. And I don't know. It's weird to me to have groups of people talking about that stuff and processing it kind of publicly on stage, because it does feel very much like group therapy, but it's group therapy for an audience. And again, this is that kind of performative histrionics. And then the woman, so in this room, she got kicked out for saying that, and then they let her back in. And then this is when it shifted from group therapy to struggle session. And they said they'd let her back in as long as she apologized, and she did. But then she didn't apologize the way that they demanded and liked. So they kicked her out again, and then they let her come back in again to try again. I mean, it was painful to listen to.
It's traumatic to her. It's traumatic to her to be kicked out.
But it's also just, it's so performative. All of it feels so performative to me. But like I was saying, some of this, I didn't know. You see a lot of this kind of, I've been, you know, mobbed by a lot of this kind of, I don't know, there's some part of it that's woke or something, whatever term you want to use, but I've been mobbed by pretty much every group on Twitter, like from the Jordan Peterson acolytes to the Elon Musk to the Q to the Donald Trump MAGA people to the far left and Antifa. I mean, all of them at one point or another, they've come after me. And this particular group of people, I see people tweeting like this, and I really didn't think that it was real. But then hearing it on Clubhouse, I realized, oh no, this is real. It's not just like something someone's tweeting. They really talk like this in real life. It was wild.
How do you separate like performative histrionics from like sometimes I see it a little bit differently. Sometimes I see it as some like a cry for help, like someone who. They want attention, and that is might be literally true, but like they want attention because they don't feel like a lot of people have been listening to them, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily a bad thing to want attention, you know, right? I mean,
no.
Me and you want attention in all sorts of ways, right? Like
this whole culture is a cry for help.
Right, 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 right. So how do you
our entire culture is a cry for help.
Yes, and it's a shame. It's sad. It's sad. You know, like, but so how can we like listen to each other more, but also like I feel like I hear what you're saying about the performative aspects sometimes, but then sometimes I don't think there's a performative aspect. Sometimes I think some people attribute a performative aspect to some situations that are not. Do you know what I mean?
Right. No, that's true. And I think even the performative aspect, there is a kernel of truth in it. And this is part of what is so challenging about the process of mediation. So this is the book I always refer to pretty much in every podcast, which is by Thomas de Zengotita, Mediated. And he talks about, you know, what is real. And in this world where we're all commodities and we're all being flattered constantly because everything is being personalized for us everywhere we go, why wouldn't we think that we can micromanage the language of everyone around us? And why wouldn't we think that we can micromanage the environment? And it makes sense that these younger generations who grew up with iPhones in their hand, to think that they could manage the world. And now you're seeing tons of people, even like this whole idea of the vaccines, which is fine. I think there should be a healthy amount of science backing up why it's important to be a guinea pig and take this vaccine. Some generations got to do it. But the wanting to micromanage every person in your environment and make sure that they're vaccinated, that's like a weird level of crazy to me that doesn't seem crazy to younger people. And I wonder if it's purely just a generational thing where they're just used to having environments and technologies that bend to their will.
Well, you said a lot of great things there, but one thing is it never occurred to me the I part in the iPhone is pretty narcissistic, or at least self-centered. What if Steve Jobs called it the Wii phone? Would that have changed everything?
Maybe. That's really that would be. Yeah, but he just knew how humans were. No one's buying a Wii phone.
No one's buying a Wii phone. wait. That's a funny quote. Like, no one's buying a Wii phone. Bridget Fantasy. No. I mean, you're right about human nature is that it's more attractive. It's like iPhone. But that just was the first time it ever dawned on me. You know, like there's an I there, you know.
Yeah, all of these things. It's not. Yeah, it's funny. I was I was reading, I save a lot of old magazines, and I've been working on trying to get my book in some form to try and sell and shop. And one of the magazines I saved was right around, I think it was right around 2000, and it was the generation, the millennials was what they called it. It was a New York Times magazine, and it was all about just the narcissistic generation that was coming up with all of the technology and then social media through kind of, you know, we are all our own little empires now. And you see everything kind of fragmenting, which anyone probably could have predicted if they had thought, I mean, YouTube, all of it, it's all this process. I'm not sure I can understand why people are feeling so anxious and depressed and restless, because it is so much external validation that everyone's clamoring for constantly. And in between projecting our own insecurities into these little doom boxes constantly, and then we're reacting to everybody's projected insecurities. I mean, I think we talk a lot about mental health and give lip service to it, but we really need to start doing the work to take care of our own mental health. And generally that means logging out, going offline, taking breaks, being active. You know, I was looking at this whole study the other day about how much weight people gained in the pandemic.
Tell me about it.
It's crazy though, because I was online, you know, when you go on YouTube, one of my favorite rabbit holes is like the working out rabbit holes. And I know how people are, I understand how people can gain weight, but there's no excuse. There's so much free workout. You know, you can just log. It's never been easier to get an education, to go work out in your home. It's never been easier to do so many of these things. And it really does show how constitutionally lazy we are on some level. All of us. I mean, I would like to blame just the algorithms, but it's not just that. I know my day is better when I don't wake up and start scrolling. I know that. Does that mean I don't do it 70% of the time? No.
Yeah. I mean, I think about this all the time, believe it or not. You know, I think, well, I mean, look, we know, like, that eating that cheeseburger is not going to make us healthy. Like we know what, like we basically know what to do to be healthy. Like, you know, like work out, like eat, you know, but why does no one do it except these super freaks, like these trainers, you know?
It's weird to me. This is something I contemplate all the time because it seems to fly in the face of Darwin. I don't understand why it's so hard to do stuff that's good for us. I need somebody to explain this to me, and I could try.
I mean, maybe we'll wait till I'm on your podcast. You can ask me the evolutionary psychology of why people don't do things that are good for them. Because that'd be an interesting conversation. Yeah. I mean, our genes.
I mean, I know they did. Yeah. Sorry, go on.
Do you want me to explain it to you?
No, I would like to have you on the podcast to explain it to
me. Oh, great. But oh, awesome.
I know that they did a study pretty recently in the past couple of years, and it showed that even people who like going to the gym experience some kind of resistance before they go, because from an evolutionary perspective, you're supposed to be conserving energy. You're not supposed to be like expending all that. This is their theory. They think it's because you're just wired to only exert energy when you absolutely have to. And so the thought of exerting energy for no reason, there's like a fundamental basic resistance, even for people who are gym rats and love it.
That's an interesting hypothesis. I'm not convinced by that hypothesis. Sometimes people tell really elaborate what they're called just so stories, you know, to explain things that aren't really grounded in science. Because you know, it takes a lot of energy. I mean, perhaps there's something to it because it takes a lot of energy expenditure to think, you know, you burn a lot of calories just thinking, you know. So maybe that could maybe help explain why we're lazy in terms of our thinking as well. You know, like it's a lot easier to just be like, you know, like veg out.
TikTok. You know. Turn my brain to pudding, TikTok.
Are you on TikTok?
Pudding.
Are you on
no.
TikTok? Wait, what do you mean my no? I'm on TikTok.
I'm 42 years old, first of all.
So what?
My young nephews are on TikTok. TikTok is for children.
Bridget.
And Chinese spies. It's Chinese spyware.
Bridget, I'm not sending you my TikTok dance videos then.
Oh, okay. it turns your brain to pudding.
I feel assaulted for, you know.
You feel violated.
I feel violated. You're because like, I'm so proud. I'm so
speech is violence.
So proud of my TikTok dance video. Speech is violence. No, that's an interesting, the speech is violence thing. Should we double click on that? Because that's a really interesting one that a lot of people are saying that these days. I'm trying to think of it from a psychological, clinical perspective.
I'll tell you my theory.
Okay, tell me your theory.
Enough people have been punched in the face.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
That's
so
my theory.
So
not
yeah,
enough
it's
people have
I get your
actual
point there.
Violence. Yeah, I mean, I think violence is violence, and speech is generally one of the ways we can tone it down. You know, it's one of the ways we can find our way out of ending up in fisticuffs. I mean, we can find our way into it with just talking shit. I come from the East Coast, but you can. I would hope that we would be able to have conversations that even if there are two guys who are kind of getting into it and they're about to fight in a bar, there's always someone else with their language. Like, come on. You know, we use language to tone it down, hopefully. And I guess you can use it to dial things up, but it's not, I don't see it as actual violence. To me, it just seems like a very easy and manipulative way to control people, which is why I don't like it, because who determines what speech is violence? If there's no way to discern what is actually violence and what speech is violence, who gets to be the arbiter of what speech is violent? It's a shape-shifting form that nobody can really grasp and changes every single day. And that's my biggest problem with it, is that now you're taking this thing and using it to manipulate people and or cancel people, which is a term I like never want to talk about again. Or
oh yeah, I won't ask that question about cancel. I'm just bored
with the conversation.
You're just bored. It's like enough already with that.
Well, because I feel like people entered after Trump and they're like, oh, cancel code. I'm like, welcome to 2015, guys. Like, some of us have been having this conversation for like 5 years.
That's
I'm glad
really
that
point.
You can have it now that Trump is gone, but the rest of us are sick of it.
It's a really good point. And with the words are violence thing, I just want to circle back for a second. Like, from a psychology perspective, we know that psychological avoidance, or what's called experiential avoidance, is a big predictor of mental illness. You know, like mental health is not served. You know, you're not likely to have mental health if you are always treating everything as something you need to avoid or something you need to fear or something that's a threat. You know, you start to move towards what you fear and become curious about it. And that's when you start to bit by bit engage more with the world and with yourself. So I think that there is, you know, the thing which that's a problem with trigger warnings, you know, is that it's teaching people that they should fear words, you know, and should fear engaging in ideas that make them uncomfortable and things of that nature. But you could see, you know, in terms of more severe things, though, if someone's had most, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, some words you can see how it can trigger automatically. They didn't ask to be triggered, but just because of the way our human amygdala works, you know, it can trigger that fear response.
Yeah, and verbal abuse is real. That's a real thing that happens. You can verbally abuse somebody, but I don't I still don't think it's the same as physically abusing someone. There needs to be a that those things are different. It's just, it's a different experience entirely. And I'm not saying one is better or worse. In many ways, I think psychological manipulation and psychological abuse can be much harder to heal from in some ways than even physical trauma, because it's not as obvious, but it's still not, it's just there. If we don't have a separation of those things, if there's no difference between words and violence, what we, I feel like we're, that is catastrophic for society.
I'll leave that point there. It's a good point. I have some more lighter questions for you. Like, what was it like being on Curb Your Enthusiasm?
That was really fun. It was really, you know, one of those moments where I was reminded why I moved to LA and the dreams I had of moving to LA on a totally small time level. But it was, that was, I think, the most, I love the show. I jokingly always say that I only want to play a hostess or a waitress in anything that I'm ever in, because that was what I did for so many years. And so it was great to be able to just play myself in many ways. And it was a really fun episode. I didn't know that I got to be in the, somebody joked there, like, was the direction that the director gave you just do what you do on Twitter? As I was like leading him to the MAGA hat. Like, I see your point. That's not what I do on Twitter, but I get it. It's a funny joke. And yeah, it was fun. You know, it's fun to like be in makeup and get your makeup and hair done and be talking to, get moved around by the, like, it, all the PAs and have them offer you water and food and be in the, it's just so cool. I mean, that was what I hoped to do when I moved out here, was to create stuff and make stories and make people laugh. And it's, you know, you catch me at a time in my life, if I was really to be totally real, where I am definitely struggling with where I find myself in relationship to why I came out here. And I feel that I keep taking steps in the direction of being some kind of accidental pundit. And I really just would rather be a comedian or a writer, because I didn't really, I'm not like some victim of the culture wars. I obviously opened my big mouth and like tweeted myself into the center of this crap, but and said yes to people having me on their shows and talking. And I feel like I'm so grateful for the people that I've been able to meet through this, but I think being on that show is just a reminder that I'm not, that's really what I, that was my intention when I came out here. You know, that was my dream, was to just be writing on one of those shows or be on a show or, and it was, so in some ways it was amazing. And in other ways it was kind of bittersweet, just to, it forced me to recognize, you know, maybe I'm a little bit farther off the path than I realize.
I wouldn't say
that. Or maybe that's not my path.
Because that's not how I would frame the situation at all. I mean, you're living your karma right now, and it's so obvious to me. You know, there's a beautiful unfolding of self-actualization happening right in front of my eyes. So what was it like wearing a Tucker Carlson shirt for a week in LA?
That was fun. People either didn't know him at all. I think more people would know him now than before, because it was pretty early in the and a lot of people just gave me dirty looks. It's funny how escalated that seems so quaint and adorable now, because then it was the MAGA hats, and then it was the masks, and now it feels like anything can be used as something that people will give you dirty looks for. So I'm more concerned with, you know, it was a fun experiment and troll of the Los Angeles population, but it was also just very revealing as to, you know, people liked it too. And I think they felt like they were being they're like, representation matters. And I feel like they saw, because I think so many people in LA are underground. In their either libertarian or center right or even right wing beliefs, because they just in general to kind of survive in the how it is in the community, you kind of just I feel like they just don't talk about what they believe and they don't push back. They just kind of listen when people are talking about politics. And now I've started to learn, you know, who the underground libertarian or Republicans are at any social situation, because they're the ones just like nodding their head and not talking. Not agreeing, but not talking either. You know, they're like, I'm not going to push back on this.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting experiment. It was, I like to be mischievous. There is that part of me that just
totally
likes pushing buttons. I think it's funny.
There's a picture of you like that. There's a picture, a really funny picture of you where you're like, right? Like, do you know that picture I'm talking about?
That's, there's a picture of me from today that came out like that, from Dumpster Fire's, thumbnail that we used.
That's what I saw.
Because yeah. I have, yeah. That's, this is my vaccine passport face.
Now, did you get the vaccine today? Is that right?
I did get it today.
Bridget Fettesy got her vaccine today. Like, this is a big deal.
I got microchip today.
Congratulations.
I texted. Thank you. I was like, all right, sweet, whatever. I'm so whatever about it.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't announce it. Yeah.
No, because I'm not going to hide it. I'm not going to announce it because that I understand why people are announcing it, because they want people to encourage people to go do it. But I completely understand why somebody would not want to do it and why they would have hesitations. I wish we just had more. I get accused of like being Little Miss Both Sides and trying to both sides everything. Like, it's not a freaking curse. It's not. It's like it's some shtick that it's an act. It's not. I really can understand how people are getting to the place that they're getting to. I can see why someone might be looting, even why somebody would feel so. I don't necessarily have to agree with something to try and understand how somebody might get to that place where you're wearing horns at the Capitol. Like, I'm fascinated by psychology. I want to know how that part of me that's curious about humanity wants to know how people. I just wish that I was my superpower. I wish I could just jump into anyone's body and understand why they're doing what they're doing and thinking what they're thinking any time. And I wish that we could approach all of these situations with a little bit more compassion instead of just the default that everybody has to like shame everybody. Shame. It's such a functional, it really is quite a effective tool at bullying people.
I agree. Especially if you're like an empathetic person. I feel like you're most vulnerable if you're an empathetic person, because it'll hit you the most if you feel like you've hurt someone's feelings, right? And they say, right? You know, like, it's almost like the assholes are kind of really winning in this space.
Yeah. I forget what I was crying about the other night when I went to bed, and I was like, people just think that it was because I had that. I'm like pro vaccine, anti-vaxport. I just don't like the idea of it. It creeps me out. I think that all of these institutions can't be trusted with any more power and information than they already have. And that's really kind of where I fall on it. And I wrote a piece. And people were telling me that I wanted people to die. And I went to bed and I was crying. You know, I got upset by the end of the night. I was, and I, I'd be lying if I said I have a pretty thick skin, definitely, after being in the Thunderdome for 5 years now, I guess, or more, six, seven. I definitely take stuff in. You know, I don't, because I don't want to hurt anybody. And I really sometimes have to ask myself the question. I remember when I was really coming into right-wing media, where I just started, they were the only people who would even have a conversation with me about anything during the 2000, during the whole Trump years. Nobody on the left wanted to hear, hey, why do you feel like you're being kicked out of the left wing? Yeah. And so I would just go and have these conversations, but then am I hurting people? Am I hurting populations? I mean, I feel like puny, stupid little me doesn't have that much power, first of all. But second of all, I don't want to hurt.
It's not your goal.
I want to talk to people and understand where they're coming from. And, I don't like it when people fight. As much as I love pushing people's buttons, which I realize is an inconsistency because I think it's kind of funny. That's more playful though. I don't want to push people's buttons, like make them mad, but I hate it. It is like I talked to, John Wood Jr. about this, just being a child of divorce and the oldest of five and growing up with all the fighting. And then more fighting with my mom and my stepdad. I want everybody to like be okay. You know, I don't like the constant conflict. America feels like my upbringing right now. I hate it.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I mean, I feel like, you know, I think we both use humor as a tool there. You know, it's a real superpower. You know, that and no one's talking about it. No one's talking about how humor is a superpower for these really serious divides that we're seeing. And it's a way of showing everyone how we're all absurd, you know, like, and we need to do more of that. Which lessons from AA do you think American politics could benefit from, you know?
Yeah. Well, one, admit you have a problem. Whatever, it's not, something's not functioning right. I feel like the individual, it's more on the individual level even than the, I just wish there was like a 12-step program just for life. You know, I think that this is why people gravitate to guys like Jordan Peterson, because he offers a certain amount of framework. And there's, you know, I was thinking about something earlier when we were talking, just how, when we were talking about why is it so hard to do the things that you don't want to do. And when I first got sober, I basically had to treat every day like opposite day. I had to do the things I didn't want to do and avoid doing the things I wanted to do. And that was my reality for many, 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 the early 2 years, I would say. And someone gave me a great quote that I pretty much live by now, which is, you can't think your way into new actions, but you can act your way into different thinking. And it's just habit building. Love that. It's so true. I'm like, you're not going to think your way out of losing weight. You have to actually do something differently and do it over and over and over again until that thing becomes a habit. And it's not easy to do those things. Getting sober is, I always say, it's the hardest thing I've ever done and the best thing I've ever done. But did it teach me a lot about just dealing with the, you know, interacting with the world and knowing where I'm powerless. Like that is something that is so empowering, which I realize is a paradox, but there is something so empowering about recognizing I can't control really anything. I can control what I eat. I always say this. I can control my media diet, my actual diet, if I'm getting exercise, what kind of person am I to the immediate people? Am I being kind to, am I a good daughter, sister, aunt? You know, am I reaching out and caring about people? Am I waking up and asking what I can give to the world? Those are things I can control. Everything else, not even the results of my work. I can't control any of it. The response to my work, the results of it, how many likes anything gets, how many, all of it is just, all of that is completely out of my control, as well as generally what's going on in the culture war, what's going on in the, in our politics, what's going on in the world, what's going on with the weather. You know, I just, there's, it's like 99% of everything going on in this moment is pretty much out of my control.
And the things that are out of your control, you're not victims of. That's the interesting step that you're making there, I think. You're saying, these things are out of my control, but I'm still not going to let them be, you know, victimize me.
No, because I, if I had that mentality, I would be not sitting here talking to you. There's many things that have happened in my history, choices I made, but also things that were completely out of my control, that had I bought into the idea that it was something that was happening to me forever, you know, this was that I, if I bought into that victimhood mentality, then I would not be here. I have a great therapist. She's always like, stop asking what's happening to you and start asking what's happening for you. And I love that.
Because like your therapist.
I have, yeah, she's the best. She's not traditional. So she's not the kind of therapist that's like, tell me how you think about that. She'll be like, that's a bad idea.
She keeps it real with you.
Yeah, she's so real. I love her. I need that. I need someone who's going to, I need someone who's not going to coddle me and who's going to call me out on my BS. I also have siblings who are really great at that.
That's something I never got as a child. I wasn't, you know, being an only child.
You were an only child?
Yeah. Yeah. Being an only child. You know, I never got that. I missed that. I missed it, you know, but.
I mean, it has its ups and downs.
Yeah, it's not all good.
You always knew where your stuff was when you left it there. That's a huge advantage in life.
That's true. Oh, Bridget, look, I absolutely adore you. And I just want to end this podcast by saying I'm really glad that you came on the Psychology Podcast. You know, you made the show not a friendly family show anymore. But
you know, oh, no.
I'm joking. I'm joking.
You can edit out my swears.
All the cuss words.
Bleep them.
Okay, I'll curse out. I'm going to keep them in. I'll put in the explicit rating. But
I try so hard, and sometimes it just comes out.
But no, be you. This is what I'm saying. Stay you. Be you. Thank you so much. It was a delight chatting with you today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, if you'd prefer a completely ad-free experience and would like early access to new episodes, you can join us at patreon.com/psychpodcast. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show. And tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.